Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, your host for the next hour. Today, Laurie Mercier, in conversation with reporter Connor Eccles, takes a deep dive into the cozy relationship between the security states of Israel and the U.S. to explore what that means for repression at home and military adventures abroad, specifically the joint U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. In their Left in the Law segment, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker discuss conflicts between recognizing the contributions of Noam Chomsky to the left and confronting his blind spots and his failure to take seriously sexual abuse claims against his good friend Jeffrey Epstein. We'll close our show today with a musical tribute to Country Joe McDonald, a key figure in the protest music scene of the 60s. He died this month at the age of 84. First of all, I want to remind you that what you hear on the Old Mole is not what you'll hear in the corporate media. We have an alternative take on the world. If you like what you hear, please support the Moles by supporting KBOO. You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give or texting KBOO to 44321. The KBOO community thanks you. When it comes to the mechanisms of domination, repression, and the maintenance of capitalist hegemony, the U.S. and Israel are the best allies. They share training, tools, and tactics from methods of surveillance to the creation of narratives that obscure the truth. What goes down in the West Bank can be seen on the streets of Minneapolis. Laurie Mercier speaks with journalist Connor Eccles about some of the consequences of this close Israeli-U.S. relationship.
Good morning. I'm speaking with Connor Eccles, who is a reporter for Responsible Statecraft, a publication by the Quincy Institute. He was previously the managing editor of the Non-Zero newsletter, and his work has appeared in The Intercept, The New Arab, and Washington Post Opinions. Today, we're talking about some of the deep relationships between the United States and Israel and how these connections affect U.S. policies. Welcome to KBOO, Connor Eccles.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Laurie.
Well, you've published a series of important articles in Responsible Statecraft, which we'll link to on the Old Mole Variety page on the KBOO website. But let's start with what you call the increasing mind meld between security agencies in Israel and the United States. What has been the relationship between federal agencies such as ICE and Customs and Border Patrol with their counterparts in Israel?
Yeah, absolutely. So I started looking into this story as I think a lot of commentators were making comparisons between what we saw from American security officials in Minnesota to what had happened in the West Bank over the years, and found that there's actually quite a lot here. You could split it into two things. So there's this official cooperation and then informal cooperation driven by NGOs. On the official side, the U.S. has consistently over the years, since creating DHS as a separate entity following 9/11, organized trainings alongside Israeli security officials at which American ICE and CBP officers learned an Israeli approach to counterterrorism. They have funded research by Israeli officials about things like countering violent extremism in the 2010s and had them present on that at conferences involving ICE and CBP officials. And they've also, due to Congress's involvement in particular, had a great deal of technology transfer. We're talking about, you know, surveillance technology and other things that make that are purportedly for dealing with terrorism, but in the case of ICE and CBP are used often to deal with migrants or with protesters, including technologies from Israeli companies like Cellebrite and Paragon, which allow you to hack hack into phones without a password. And then on the other unofficial side, you have NGOs and American organizations like the Anti-Defamation League, ADL, or JINSA, the Jewish Institute for National Security of America, both of which have aligned themselves over the years very much with the right wing of Israeli policy. And they, for the last couple of decades, have sponsored trips for all sorts of senior American law enforcement officials to Israel to learn from their Israeli counterparts. And, you know, some of the people who've gone on those trips include now senior officials within these organizations. So, for example, I believe that it's Joseph Har Hay, who's now an assistant chief for CBP, and he attended one of these with JINSA back in 2018, I believe. So you've got both this official and unofficial sort of strand that has just slowly brought the cultures of these security states together.
Well, you have some pretty horrifying quotes from some of the participants, some of the American participants who have noted that, you know, they were surprised by the kind of level of violence that Israeli security agencies used against Palestinians. Do you want to say any more about that?
Absolutely. So those quotes were originally reported by Jewish Currents, so just want to give credit there. But it's very notable that I guess it's useful to think of this as the shift between when law enforcement officials think of themselves as dealing with criminals versus terrorists. You know, for example, that's what we're talking about in what we saw in Minnesota is when you're framing the enemy as a terrorist, you use much more expansive force, and that is the type of force that Israeli officials have used against Palestinians that they see as terrorists over the years. So that's really what I think a lot of the difference is here, and a lot of the sort of framing difference.
Well, especially since, you know, people are always pointing out that ICE officials or people hired by ICE these days have less and less training. But certainly the level of violence directed against migrants, legal and perhaps not undocumented, as well as US citizens, you know, these kinds of Israeli counterterrorism tactics are showing up in places like Minnesota, which we witnessed fairly recently. And so, how have these counterterror tactics applied to an ever-growing number of people in the United States?
Again, that is a lot as much in this rhetorical and sort of operational shift from the Trump administration as anything. There's also great reporting from other people that I linked to in the piece about how just law enforcement in general has taken on some more of this mission over the years, including the people that have gone and done trainings over in Israel. But just, you know, in general, the framing of, you know, obviously Kristi Noem is no longer going to be the head of the Department of Homeland Security, but she would frequently describe people who had been killed, who were activists or who were doing work around the protests as terrorists or as, you know, trying to assist in terrorist activities. And so it's just this ever expanding sort of target set for the national security state. And it seems as if it might continue to expand as the Trump administration pursues war on terror at home and abroad.
And we see this use of extreme force and racial and ethnic profiling that really reflects how Israel is using these same tactics against Palestinians.
Yes, that's right. That's a particular thing that I spoke with a former senior DHS official about, and they were very concerned. I mean, even they saw a presentation from an Israeli counterterrorism expert at some sort of seminar or some sort of conference that they attended during their time at DHS. And they were talking to another one of their colleagues, and just the colleague said, you know, why are we giving a foreign government funding to tell us to do this? Why is DHS doing this? And I think it's galling to a lot of people within the national security state as well as without.
Well, let's discuss the U.S.-Israel war on Iran. Many people have asked this question: why exactly did the administration launch a regime change war in Iran? And was it Israel that pushed the U.S. into war, or a joint effort by the two countries to maintain their hegemony in the region. And I've read and listened to a lot of geopolitical analysts who have been debating the degree to which Israel pushed Trump into going to war. From your research and reporting, what are your conclusions?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a chicken or the egg problem because obviously it's always going to be a little bit of both at the end of the day. But it was interesting that the day after the war broke out, I went to a conference sponsored by J Street, which is a self-described, I guess, progressive pro-Israel organization that has a pretty significant influence both in Washington and elsewhere. And so I was at that conference, and one of the panels, there was a debate on this very question. And on one side, the argument was, well, look, if Israel didn't exist, if there was no, Israeli interest to defend in the Middle East, if the US was not interested in defending those interests, then we would have no reason to go after Iran. Because after all, Iran has weapons that can only reach within its region. It has never made a credible threat to the US homeland. So it takes a very expansive view of US interests to view that as necessary. But another panelist who's very interesting, or your listeners may be interested in him as well, Matt Duss from the Center for International Policy, former advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders, and he made the argument that this lets the US off the hook. Right, that there is sort of in the way that I described with the Department of Homeland Security, there's a certain mind meld between a part of the Israeli security establishment and a part of the American security establishment that at the end of the day agrees on the principle that the US should be the dominant force in the Middle East and that the primary threat to that dominance is Iran, and that Israel should be sort of our sheriff on the ground. Making these things happen. Now, in the very sort of fine-grained details of what actually led to this particular war, that's what was really funny is that the Trump administration was making it seem ambiguous on this question, right? Because you had Marco Rubio come out and say that, well, Israel was going to attack, they had their opportunity, and so we needed to attack as well. So that's sort of the more fine-grained and proximate thing. And I think that the timing very much was driven at least as much by Israel as the US, but it's sort of hard to pin all of it on Israel given America's overwhelming power.
And history in the region.
Right.
Well, it seems to me that this is all related to Gaza, too, is it not? I mean, why does the United States continue to support a genocide there? And now an accelerated ethnic cleansing in the West Bank. I mean, settlers are executing families. Nothing's stopping them, or no one is stopping them. So increased violence in the West Bank now as well. But yet the United States, really continues to support Israel's genocide.
Right. Now, I appreciate you bringing in the West Bank because that's often ignored in these conversations, the ongoing displacement of Palestinians in the West Bank. And I've been there. I've been there on several visits over the years. And I think it's a little hard for people to picture from a distance the extent to which it is so thoroughly divided between, Israelis and Palestinians and the way that Israelis live in these settlements. They have their own roads, they have total impunity. Really, in the West Bank against local Palestinians, and that's such a big problem. In terms of the question of how the war relates to the how the war in Iran relates to the war in Gaza?
Well, I guess I'm just reflecting about this question about is it Israel's policies and efforts that pushed the United States into war with Iran or a joint effort? And I think that question also applies to Gaza or Palestinians as well, that the United States is also linked so closely linked with Israel, it's difficult to separate. Who's supporting whom? But both countries are, this axis of evil in the region. As so many Americans have turned away from supporting Israel because of its live stream genocide and militarism, now we see in Lebanon, and the growing concern over Israel's control or influence on U.S. politics, Israel is increasing its investments in influencers of all kinds on social media, in controlling the mainstream U.S. media, and expanding Christian Zionism. And I think, as you've probably pointed out, there are more Christian Zionists than Jewish Zionists in this
Right.
country. So you've written about how an Israeli-funded organization is working to boost evangelical support for Israel. Can you tell us about this operation?
Yeah, this is a truly strange story that I co-wrote with my colleague Nick Cleveland Stout, who also does excellent, he's done a lot of great reporting. So he's always right on the story. But basically what we found was that this organization called Show Faith by Works, which is registered as a foreign agent on behalf of Israel with the federal government, so this is an explicit agent-client relationship between the Israeli government and this group. They have tried a few different methods for trying to sort of propagandize pro-Israel views to especially young evangelicals, because there's a really deep fear from the Israeli government that they're losing young people across the board, and that includes young conservatives and Republicans often, and young evangelicals who might have supported Israel once upon a time, but who no longer see that as a valid point of view, either because they sympathize more with the Palestinians or they just want America to stop spending a bunch of money and doing a bunch of dumb stuff abroad. And so what they've done most recently now is launched this Bible study program, of all things, called the Storyline of Israel, run by, so it's Hear From Us, and then the Storyline of Israel is this sub thing. So they're sort of rebranding because they got some bad press, well, we gave them some bad press a few months ago. And so there's been a lot of pushback from evangelicals because there was talk of them, geofencing churches during services to do targeted ads and stuff like that. But now they've got this program that sort of purports to show the real story of Israel, connects the Bible to modern Israel, and allow people to deepen their experience of faith through that. But the problem is that it's just a really thinly veiled propaganda thing, right? The interviewees you would think would be normal Christian theologians doing, various things to talk about modern Israel, but instead it's people like Yishai Fleischer, who is one of the loudest and most extreme voices of the settler movement in the West Bank, who has consistently called for the expulsion of all Palestinians from Gaza and complained that Qatar won't take them, for example. Yeah, he had like a podcast episode entitled "Gazans Gotta Go" to give you a sense of his demeanor.
Very Christian-like, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so you've got all these just over the top personalities and ones who have nothing to say about Christian theology necessarily in a way that would be appropriate for a Bible study, but instead it's really just trying to say that Israel is in some way essential to modern Christianity, and that is a deeply disputed position among Christians.
Yeah, as you report, there has been some pushback by many of these evangelical churches. I mean, resenting the geofencing campaign and this kind of foreign influence.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, I mean, any faith group is going to be frustrated at the idea of being targeted as a faith group for this type of thing, right? I'm sort of surprised that these guys are surprised that they've gotten so much pushback, right? It's a very unusual thing to try to shape the theological views of people who don't share your religion. So yeah, that's just been extremely controversial. And again, like I said, a lot of young evangelicals today are similar to a lot of young Americans saying that we do not want our tax dollars to go supporting, Israeli war crimes. And it's hard to argue with them.
Yeah, and it just underscores the level to which the Israel government is trying to influence all manner of communities in the United States to support Israeli policies. F
Right.
finally, Connor, you've noted that a coalition of human rights organizations, anti-war groups, and Christian churches are urging the U.S. to cancel its $210 million purchase of next generation cluster munitions from an Israeli state-owned company, citing the severe foreseeable dangers these weapons pose to civilians. I mean, what do you make of this purchase? And I'm wondering if it reflects another way that Israel influences U.S. policies in encouraging or engaging in warfare that does not consider civilians.
Absolutely. Well, I don't think that you need to do too much to convince the Pete Hegseth-led Department of Defense to ignore those things, but there is definitely a pattern here. Cluster munitions were banned by the vast majority of countries in the 1990s because they are inherently dangerous to civilians. They leave behind all these little bomblets that infamously resemble toys. And that when they're unexploded are often picked up specifically by children, and it specifically maim and kill children. So that's a it's an indiscriminate weapon, and it's a very scary weapon. But the US made the decision to never sign on to that particular convention that banned the use of cluster munitions. And so we maintained a stockpile of them, even though we stopped using them in operations in the late 2000s. And during the Ukraine war, the US made the decision under Biden to transfer cluster munitions to Ukraine for use on the front lines, which seems to have depleted our supplies of these weapons, and now we're looking to refill them by getting this contract with an Israeli company. And also, as I note in that story, we are seeking buyers within the United States. We're seeking weapons manufacturers within the United States to manufacture the same model. So, yeah, I mean, I think we're probably entering an era in which cluster munitions are going to be used again in a way that has proven to be disastrous historically everywhere that they've appeared.
Well, we've got to fight back, and we really appreciate your excellent reporting, Connor Eccles, for helping us do that and for joining us today. We'll link to some of your pieces from Responsible Statecraft on the KABU website.
Okay, well,
Thanks
thanks so
again.
much. I appreciate it.
That was Laurie Mercier speaking with Connor Eccles about the U.S.-Israeli relationship. You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Next up, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker take up the thorny issues surrounding the 7-year relationship between revered figure on the left, Noam Chomsky, and the infamous sexual predator, Jeffrey Epstein.
There's a clever meme that has gained traction on the internet for the web of rich and powerful men who operate in a corrupt world of practices outside of the laws and moral codes governing everyday people. It's the Epstein class. A March 2nd In These Times article on the Epstein class notes that, quote, he was an equal opportunity fixer. He was just as friendly with liberals as he was with conservatives, including Summers, Clinton, and disconcertingly for the American left, Noam Chomsky. For elites like Epstein, ideological differences were superficial. The real distinction was money, power, and connections, unquote. Well, Mike, we've discussed the Epstein saga on a previous Left in the Law segment, but today we've taken on a more daunting task. How do we understand the place of Noam Chomsky, one of the most revered intellectuals of the American left, in this dark labyrinth? And is it the case that ideological differences or principles mattered little in resisting the monstrous, seductive powers of Epstein? Turning to our way of understanding Chomsky's relationship with Epstein, what have you learned about this network with the most recent release of documents?
Well, we've learned quite a bit about the Epstein class. Epstein was a procurer, and procurers are nothing new. They exist at every power level in every country and have throughout time. But Epstein was a more complicated case. He owned multiple large properties in Palm Beach, New York, Paris, at a ranch in New Mexico, as well as a private island. He had a payroll of hundreds of people, of in-house staff, legal advisors, bodyguards, chauffeurs, cooks, cleaners, gardeners, masseuses and his advisory class of women who had graduated. There's an elaborate hierarchy of attendants whose precise relationship to Epstein we'll never know. But he had remarkable seductive powers, but he worked on two different levels. The one level, the fraternal level, was where he was the bro of all these tech bros and powerful people. He would offer them sex and very targeted money at research products they would otherwise have a hard time getting. But he also had another side, a household economy, where he managed ranches he wanted to reproduce on a grand scale, like Elon Musk. He wanted to have something beyond, way beyond nuclear families, but to have a hierarchical sort of a master-servant relationship with vast numbers of people, of which he was at the top. And in that sense, his wishes are confluent with what's emerging on the far right, the modern master-servant economy that's replacing an exchange economy.
It's a kind of neo-colonial fantasy that dominates the right, where girls and women are forms of currency, but the desire is often, and this I think comes through in a lot of these files and email exchanges, that the desire is kind of homoerotic. It's really about the pleasure economy these men have with each other, where girls don't mature enough to really have agency of their own or opinions of their own. They get canceled out at a certain age of maturity. So there's a really childish, immature kind of sexuality operating here. For all the sex that this is about, I think on a certain level, it's not about sex. And you were saying it is about a particular worldview. And you were also saying that all these people are implicated in keeping this system going in the most mundane ways. But a lot of the maintenance of his world had some ordinary, everyday elements to it, like meals cooked, laundry washed, and you were saying there are probably thousands of people that were involved in these operations. You see it, some of them discussed in the services in the emails, including the ones with Chomsky that we'll turn to in a moment. But what about this idea that seems to have gathered hold in defending this 7-year relationship between Chomsky and Epstein, that so many people were pulled into it? Ideological differences or principles get canceled out. It relieves us to some kind of hard thinking about how this unfolds and what are the dynamics in play here. And so, Mike, I have read the email correspondence between Noam Chomsky and Jeffrey Epstein from 2012 until shortly before Epstein's death. And I wanted to ask you about the way these files are available now, something called jmail.com. It's a browser-based archive of the Epstein files, which were released by the US House Committee under the Epstein Files Transparency Act. Are there ethical or legal issues in going through these emails and citing them? A lot of them have the confidentiality phrase at the bottom. I asked you about this last week. Share your advice to me.
Well, these people are all public figures, and in the case of Epstein, he's dead. So I don't think there's going to be any significant legal issues about rummaging through these materials.
But
And
I'm more thinking of Chomsky and his wife. There are a lot of very intimate details about their troubles with their children. You're saying even in the case of the Chomskys that this is a matter of public record that has been brought to light as people are trying to understand it. It also, though, obligates us as leftists. How do we grant Chomsky, as this old man who continued to be very lucid and productive into his early 90s, he had a stroke 3 years ago and now is quite incapacitated. very diminished now, but up through his early 90s, he was very cogent and productive. So I think for me, it was a matter of trying to take care and not kind of recklessly pick the most sensational emails, but to try to get a sense of the patterns over time and how he might have been drawn into this long-standing relationship, which he himself and his wife, Valeria, have very much downplayed. I'm going to go backwards in time, beginning with the months before Epstein's death in 2019, an email from Noam to Jeffrey saying, Valerie is putting together documentation about the matter that I can use in a case around his children. So that had been an ongoing area where he had been consulting and drawing on the services of Epstein. And then he turns to Epstein's own problems and, quote, the horrible way you're being treated in the press and public. What the vultures dearly want is a public response, which then provides a public opening for an onslaught of venomous attacks, many from just publicity seekers or cranks of all sorts. That's particularly true now with the hysteria that has developed about abusive women, which has reached the point that even questioning a charge in a crime is worse than murder. And Valeria, she defended him, saying he was always a defender of women's rights, supported feminism, because this kind of statement that is so dismissive of women and so lacking in curiosity or care in all of the complaints around Epstein and the seriousness of the charges against him, leave me to believe he was not particularly concerned with feminism or or with questions of abuse. There was no evidence over years that he really tried to even challenge it. He might have privately, but everything in his email correspondence was pretty dismissive, including complaints against Lawrence Krauss, who initially introduced him to Epstein and who had himself faced, you know, a decade-long series of allegations about sexual misconduct and sexual abuse, including with students and colleagues. So, getting back to the phases I mentioned earlier, in the same way relationships have kind of an early courtship period and then what's called honeymoon period, where there's a period of mutual idealization and then there's some challenges faced. And then, as people navigate the challenges of life, there's a question of do we have an alliance here? A working alliance, or are we moving in different directions? So there were these tests that emerged that I think fortified an alliance between them. So let's start with the early phase, what I'm calling the courtship phase that began after 2012, and it continued for about 3 years with Jeffrey's regular offerings of gifts, kind of care packages, you know, food and carefully selected wines and dinners and visits to many of his homes, interspersed with intellectual games and playful exchanges. This went on for, you know, about 2, 3 years where they would talk about get together. They were kind of giddy expressions of affection on both sides and references to the wonderful retreats and dinner parties. And then in 2015, the relationship turned to a decidedly serious personal matter. Chomsky had married Valeria, and in December 2015, Jeffrey writes to Noam, quote, I think we should set up the foundation so that Valeria is taken care of if something were to happen to you. You can count on my help. But let's not wait too long, end quote. So this kind of was put out there and then gradually unfolded in 2016, consultations around tax issues as he sold his house in Cambridge and moved to Arizona, how you get the best tax deal, consulting around setting up a marital fund separate from the one that he had had based on his relationship with his deceased wife. And his children were starting to be expressed concern and seeking mediations to challenge this transfer of wealth to a new marital fund that they felt would benefit his new wife. And a lot of this is kind of ordinary troubles, that happen with people late in life with when they have some resources. He was not a rich man, but he did have resources. So I was struck during this period of 2016. There was still a lot of playful banter between the two of them, where Jeffrey would engage him in a kind of philosophical question or a question about his work. And it struck me, and this is where I want to stop and note the kind of stylistic through line with these emails that Jeffrey Epstein adopted. And it was notable in his other emails as well, but it was particularly notable with Chomsky because he would pick up an idea, an element of Chomsky's theorizing, particularly around generative language, and this was an area where Chomsky had really profoundly affected the field of acquisition of language, and he had gathered some critics around that theory, but Epstein really remained very attentive to his intellectual powers, and I think probably genuinely did. I began to notice, though, a kind of pattern, a kind of signature mode of communicating that I think was part of the seductiveness of Epstein, and particularly with someone like Chomsky. So I'm going to read an example. Can I read you an example of this pattern of speech and how notable it was? Because there were so many cultural references or philosophical references, and a particularly extensive engagement of kind of playful philosophical musings. So this is one from November 2018. Jeffrey, what I'm suggesting is that what the term culture means is the same as what consciousness means. Culture can be described as Russell did for consciousness, the physics and math envy habit of trying to reassure things. We experience culture, it is stubborn, transmitted, localized, contains memories, boundaries, dictum. These are words with periods, no capitals at the beginning of sentences. So this is like a stream of consciousness with many typos, intentional, I think, typos, sentence fragments, as if the searing mind of this genius, and people did think he was a genius, including apparently Chomsky, that this mind of the genius can't settle down enough or keep up with the mundane tasks of writing. And so it gave him a kind of cover intellectually, because Chomsky would kind of gather up the fragments of thought and create a kind of coherent reframing of this, what psychiatrists would call a word salad, and express deep appreciation for his brilliant insights. And indeed, in a letter in 2017, the year before, kind of a character reference letter written while he was apparently on the faculty as a visiting professor at the University of Arizona, he ends the letter by stating, "The impact of Jeffrey's limitless curiosity, extensive knowledge, penetrating insights, and thoughtful appraisals is only heightened by his easy formality without a trace of pretentiousness. He quickly became a highly valued friend and regular source of intellectual exchange and stimulation." So that indeed he did become to him. And part of what makes this problematic. The letter that he wrote in 2017 was that aside from him looking the other way and not being at all curious about the troubles surrounding Epstein, they were advising each other on their troubles. Legally, Epstein had become deeply involved, as did his lawyer and other people on his staff, helping Epstein navigate this very troubled relationship with his adult children.
Well, I think Epstein became trustworthy for Chomsky in one important area that became important, and that is the relationship of his money and his children and the whole interweb consequences of what happens when the wife of your many decades dies, and then he remarries to somebody much younger. And of course, his children act as you would expect. They are offended by this new presence. They're threatened by this new presence who might absorb monies that they would have otherwise gotten. And it's a problematic area for lots of people. And Epstein became somebody who Chomsky thought he could count on, somebody knowledgeable in this area that he had never given a second thought to. And of course, when you have somebody you trust and is important, I think the fact that he wrote that absolutely over the top letter is like letters I've written myself on behalf of other people to institutions where they need some sort of third party approval. And Chomsky's really inflating things. And he may or may not have thought all that, but he did by then unmistakably trust Epstein. And I have not reviewed all these emails, but I imagine that they move step by step where Chomsky was express a problem, Epstein would have an opinion, Chomsky would respond to that, it would be qualified or not. And over time, they developed a, you could tell me, what do you think happened? How did they develop that trust?
Let me turn to how they met. So I think, okay, that's probably true. The troubles with his children, he had been unprepared for that. It threw him. And here was this guy who seemed to know his way around finances and dealing with such matters. I want to return to those earliest emails of how they first met, because it's kind of like couples counselors who typically ask how the two people met and what drew them to one another. And for many of us, we listen for kind of fantasies and unconscious desires that can be part of the field of attraction. I went to the first emails between Chomsky and Epstein. It was March 30th, 2012. And it started with Lawrence Krauss asking Noam if he would like to be introduced to Jeffrey. Quote, "If you are willing, is there anyone I can have him contact to set up an appointment? I will owe you. He is an interesting fellow in any case." Noam responds, "Just suggest to him to write to me. It's a Sunday, I think, so it won't be when I'm at work," unquote. Lawrence replies, "You are in. He will meet with you. You, of course, owe me big time now. I was hoping I would get him out to Arizona for our deception meeting." That must have been some kind of Freudian slip in October, but he has a conflict. "So all I got out of the email was a meeting for you. Enjoy, period, Lawrence." So, Mike, this is before the new wife. This was before the troubles with the kids were on the horizon. There was something Noam was to enjoy here. And then we wonder what would be owed through this meeting. Any thoughts on that?
No, I don't. I would need to know more to have thoughts. Krauss is saying on the one hand, I owe you big time if you will respond to this guy, but he's also saying that you will owe me, implying that Chomsky will have a great relationship with Epstein and that he'll be indebted to Krauss for that. It's
I think there's always temptation with these things in going overboard with attributions. And sometimes I go for the most ordinary ones. He did fund that project of Lawrence Krauss, a big conference years before, and there was a lot of money brought to these institutions, including MIT. But I don't have the sense that that was what motivated. There was no discussion that I saw over the years of bringing grants or money in like some of the other appeals. So, but there was certainly a lot of prestige Epstein gathered over time through how he could fund things and just his wealth. And I think in the years that followed, you could see, he called him the best friend, my permanent friend for life. And Epstein says, "You can stay in my apartment in New York as long as you live." I mean, there are kind of these eternal promises at times, like vows. And it does say something that so many people fell in love with him. And what does that say about this era of patriarchy that is very misogynist, and that as wonderful and important as Chomsky's been to the left, I don't see him as a feminist after reading, spending many days on these, looking for some redemption for him. And I think there's so much to appreciate. And to me, it doesn't cancel him out, like, not wanting to read his books, but it does to me matter. It would be like if there was a feminist scholar who had been so important in the women's movement, who you read emails that were racist. I mean, it would affect how you felt about and thought about that scholar who privately said things. And so I was left with that kind of disappointment, but also how these boys' networks sometimes do cross ideological lines. Well, thanks, Mike.
That was Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker talking about how we might understand Noam Chomsky's relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. You are tuned to KBOO Portland.
And it's 1, 2, 3. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. The next stop is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7. Open up pearly gates. Well, there ain't no time to wonder why we'll be all gonna die.
If you came of age in the 60s, I'm sure you'll recognize that short clip. Those are the famous words from I Feel Like I'm Fixin' to Die, Rag by Country Joe and the Fish, along with Blowin' in the Wind by Peter, Paul and Mary, Masters of War by Bob Dylan, Give Peace a Chance by John Lennon, I Ain't Marchin' Anymore by Phil Oakes, and many, many others. The Fixin' to Die, Rag with Country Joe's characteristic dark humor captured the rage of a generation unable to stomach the vicious imperial war that was Vietnam. Protest music like his was key to galvanizing resistance against the war. Country Joe McDonald passed away this last month at the age of 84. In 1969, 300,000 to 400,000 people heard Joe play this song at Woodstock. Now, the Fish usually had a cheer for concert goers. Give me an F, give me an I, give me an S, give me an H. What does that spell? But at Woodstock, Country Joe, playing solo acoustic guitar, substituted another four-letter word beginning also with F. Imagine hundreds of thousands of people screaming the profanity at once with a clear-cut message. F the warmongers, F the capitalist pigs, F the racist, sexist, imperialist project of the United States. Joe frequently and effectively deployed satire to get his points across. In the Harlem Song from 1971, he brilliantly mocks the white tourists who flock to Harlem as a cheap and exotic spot to vacation. Never mind the racist and patronizing attitudes they brought along with them, and the resentments of the Harlem residents themselves. Here's a clip from that song.
Glorious. Breathtaking. Spectacular. Relax in the grandeur of America's yesteryear. Harlem, land of enchanting contrasts, where the romantic past touches hands with the exciting present. First, the pleasure of being received with warmth and genuine hospitality. Then, the easy adjustment to the comfort and style of superb meals, exotic beverages, colorful entertainment, and dynamite action. Doing all the wonderful things that wonderful vacations are made of. At wonderful savings, too. Yes, come to Harlem, the happy meeting ground for families with large wants and small budgets.
See colorful Harlem.
Joe was a red diaper baby, born in 1942 to two members of the Communist Party. His mother, Florence Plotnick, was a radical Jewish activist. His father, Warden McDonald, also an activist, was later called up before the House Un-American Activities Committee, which subsequently cost him his job. They named their baby boy after Joseph Stalin. During World War II, Stalin, who hailed from the countryside, was often referred to as Country Joe. The nickname then attached itself to Joe McDonald as well. As a naive 17-year-old, Joe joined the Navy for a 3-year stint in Japan. It was through this experience that he came by his sympathies for the working-class men who were called up to enforce U.S. interests abroad. Joe rightly realized the soldiers and sailors were not to blame for overseas atrocities perpetrated by his country, and he became a lifelong advocate for veterans. In 1986, he released an album titled Vietnam Experience about the horrific legacy of that war. This is a clip from the song Vietnam Never Again.
I'd like to be a general. Instead of in this bunker with rounds coming in, I'd like to be the president talking to the press. Instead of hearing caisson with shrapnel in my chest, I'll be Vietnam, you took my heart and mind. I'll be Vietnam, you made me cold before my time.
Following Joe's discharge from the Navy, he drifted to Berkeley, where he quickly became part of the countercultural scene. In 1965, he helped found the band Country Joe and the Fish. The name Fish was lifted from a Mao Zedong quote, "Revolutionaries must move amongst the people as a fish swims in the sea." Drawing on the musical traditions of folk and the blues, the Fish morphed into an electronic rock band. Political themes were their staple. Here's another clip from a song called Superbird, released in 1967, about LBJ.
Look up yonder in the sky now. What is that, I pray? It's a bird, it's a plane, it's a man insane. It's my president, LBJ. He's flying high, way up in the sky. Just like Superman. But I have got a little piece of kryptonite. Yes, I'll bring it back to land. Said, come out, Lyndon, with your hands held high. Drop your guns, baby, and reach for the sky. I've got you surrounded and you ain't got a chance. Send you back to Texas, make you work on your ranch. Yeah, yeah.
By 1970, Country Joe and the Fish had split up. Joe continued primarily as a solo artist, releasing albums with feminist, environmental, and anti-war themes. He was more a free spirit than a radical like his parents, but he knew where his sympathies lay. He's a reminder of the ways that cultural expressions of outrage and sorrow and resistance help social justice movements grow and coalesce. In just a minute, I'm going to close our show with the recording, albeit radio censored, of Joe's most famous performance at Woodstock. Stay tuned. That's it for our show this morning. Thanks to the Moles, Laurie Mercier, Jan Hocken, and Mike Snedeker for their contributions, and a special thanks to our guest, Connor Eccles. A shout out to the staff at KABU for all that they do as well. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been your host for the hour. Join us again next Monday morning for more views, reviews, and interviews from the ground up. Now, here is Country Joe at the Woodstock Festival in 1969. Thanks for listening.
Give me an F! Give me a U! Give me a C! Give me a K! What's that spell? 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 Well, come on, all of you big strong men, Uncle Sam needs your help again. Got himself in a terrible jam, way down yonder in Vietnam. Put down your books and pick up a gun, we're gonna have a whole lot of fun. And it's one, two, three, what are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn, the next stop is Vietnam. And it's five, six, seven, open up the pearly gates. Well, there ain't no time to wonder why, we're all gonna die. Now come on, Wall Street, don't be slow. Why, man, this is war, a go-go. There's plenty of good money to be made, supplying the army with the tools of the trade. Just hope and pray that if they drop the bomb, they're dropping on the Viet Cong. And it's one, two, three, what are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn, the next stop is Vietnam. And it's five, six, seven, open up the pearly gates. Well, ain't no time to wonder why, we're all gonna die. Now come on, generals, let's move fast, your big chance is here at last. Now you can go out and get those reds, cause the only good commie is one that's dead. And you know that peace can only be won when they're blowing them all the kingdom comes. Sing it! One, two, three, what are we fighting for? Don't ask me, don't give a damn. Louder! Vietnam. People, I don't know how you expect to ever stop the war if you can't sing any better than that. There's about 300,000 of you out there. I want you to start singing.